This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatto. Why are we the way we are? Researchers have found evidence for genetic links to complicated conditions such as drug and alcohol addictions, mental illnesses such as schizophrenia. There's been talk of a gene for risk-taking, among others. And now that the Human Genome Project has published its sequence of the human genetic code, is it possible to directly link genes and human behavior? Of course, it's easy to say it's all in our genes, but that would be too simplistic an answer. Certainly, our upbringing, the people who nurture us, and the environment in which we live shape our personalities and our behaviors. But how much? That's what we'll be talking about this hour, if you'd like to talk about genes, behavior, and how much each one. Nature, question, that old question, give us a call. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my guests. Matt Ridley is a science writer and author of the new book, Nature Via Nurture, Genes, Experience, and What Makes Us Human, published by HarperCollins. He joins us by phone from the UK. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Ira. Nice to be on the program again.
Thank you. Matt McHugh is a past president of the Behavior Genetics Association and a professor of psychology at the University of Minnesota. That's in the Twin Cities. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
Nancy Press is an associate professor in the Department of Public Health and Preventive Medicine at Oregon Health and Science University in Portland, Oregon. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Both Dr. McHugh and Dr. Press are presenting talks on the aspects of behavioral genetics at the meeting, being held in Washington by the American Association for the Advancement of Science and the Hastings Center, which is a bioethics think tank. Let's talk about what that is, Matt McHugh. What do we mean by behavioral genetics? What is this meeting, the meeting, all about?
Well, the meeting has two aspects to it. The first aspect is trying to understand the evidence or reviewing the evidence that genetic factors somehow play a role in complex behavioral characteristics like mental health and personality and intelligence. The second aspect of the meeting deals with the ethical implications of those findings.
Mm-hmm. Was it a great disappointment? And Matt Ridley, I know in your book you say somehow the adherents of the nurture side of the arguments have scared themselves silly at the power and inevitability of genes and missed the great lesson of all the genes are on our side, are on their side. I mean, has the Human Genome Project scared a lot of people believe more in the nurture side than the nature side?
I think people, as it were, who've traditionally been on the nurture side of the debate have in some sense seen genes as more deterministic than they are, because actually what an awful lot of genes turn out to be is devices for extracting experience from the environment, genes that set you up so that you do get the nurture side of your upbringing absorbed into the organism.
Mm-hmm. So the Human Genome Project has not settled the question by any means.
Certainly not yet. What's changed now is that we can move from a hypothesis about what a gene is doing to some very interesting results very quickly by looking at the gene in different individuals or in different species, and I think that is about to change our understanding of behavior genetics very rapidly. The work that Professor McHugh and his colleagues have done in understanding that there are genes involved in this goes so far. Now it's a matter of actually seeing which genes and how they work.
Mm-hmm. Professor Press, is there a problem about what we mean by behavior? I mean, how do we talk about genes influencing behavior? Do we have to define what a behavior is?
Well, I guess I think that's exactly the point. I think that a lot of time has been spent with the nature and nurture side trying to figure out if they should beat each other up or meet some sort of rapprochement. But I think that that the question that precedes that is what are we talking about when we're talking about behavior, and I think in some circumstances that's a little bit easier, such as schizophrenia, something where psychiatrists have spent a long time trying to make sure that they have a pretty good idea of what they mean by the phenotype, what that disease is. Mm-hmm. But I think one of the startling and disturbing things now is how many things are called behavior for which genes are there are then looked for without really thinking about how the culture we live in really sets up what we see as a behavior.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us an example in past of how, and I'm thinking about eugenics in particular, how mm-hmm. people have been over the years had tried to use eugenics to show the superiority of races and how genes might influence behaviors?
Well, certainly the superiority of races. I mean, I think what's most interesting about that, in a way, is not simply that that things like intelligence have been shown, when looked at on a group-to-group basis, to be a very bad predictor of anything. Mm-hmm. But what's most interesting to me is if you think about what groups have been assumed to be the ones who are disadvantaged intellectually over the years. So that not all that many people know that some of the very early IQ testing that was done to show that groups of immigrants from Eastern Europe in the early part of the 20th century were, in fact, genetically intellectually inferior. But what's interesting to me there is how much the scientific search was shaped by the politics of the time. And mm-hmm. I don't see any reason why that should not still be the case.
Mm-hmm. Is it politically incorrect these days to think about the possibility, now that we've discovered all these genes, that the genes might influence different people in different ways, and we might think of these as racist sort of ideas?
Well, I think that most, and I think Dr. McGee should comment, but I think that most behavioral geneticists will tell you that that variations in intelligence as measured by genes only make sense when you look within one group, that really behavioral genetics isn't set up to make comparisons between one group and another group.
Mm-hmm. Matt Ridley?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that on the whole it is hard to generalize across groups. And in fact, one of the things that we've learned from genetics, and it did come as a big surprise, was just how little of the genetic variation that there is in the human population turns out to be between groups as opposed to between individuals. In other words, about 85% of the difference between any two average human beings is accounted for by the fact that they're different individuals within the same group, or you only add about 15% if you look at individuals across groups. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a surprising fact, and it shows that we're all descended from a small group of human beings who came out of Africa 100,000 years ago or so. And it does mean that that racial differences, for example, are skin deep on the whole.
Mm-hmm. I think we also shouldn't forget that that the instruments that we use to measure certain things are also likely to be fallible. There's some wonderful research that came out of Stanford, where groups of blacks and white students were given identical tests, and half of them were told that that it were tests of intelligence, and the other half were told that they were not at all tests of intelligence. And when the white students in either condition did equally well, but the black students did much more poorly when they were told that their IQ was being tested. So that, to me, is an example of how culture can affect the data on which behavioral geneticists may then be doing their searches.
Matt Ridley, you talk about a gene in your book, a gene called MAOA, that makes people more prone to antisocial and criminal behavior, but only if they have experienced abuse as children. Very interesting.
This is a fascinating study. It's a study by Terry Moffat here in London, and what she's found by following a group of New Zealand children is that, as you say, in order to predict antisociality in this group, antisocial behaviors of various kinds, you need to understand both the genotype and the phenotype. The nurture, the effect of the environment. And what she's suggesting here is that it's proved very hard to move from behavior genetics, from twin studies and things like that. You can use twin studies to show that there is a degree of genetic influence on antisocial behavior, bound to be. There's also a degree of environmental influence. But in order to find out which genes are involved, you've got to find out how those genes are interacting with the environment. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that having a low active version of this gene predisposes you to have it to being more sensitive to the environmental impact. And I think that's the kind of way in which we're going to find that these kind of genes work, that they're predispositions for responding to things in the environment often.
Matt McGee?
Yeah, if I could interject.
Yes, go ahead.
I agree the study is a very provocative and important study, well designed, but the history in this area tells us that we shouldn't be confident of anything until it's replicated. And the study has not yet been replicated. I agree with Matt Ridley, though, that ultimately most behavioral geneticists do believe that the way genes operate will depend upon the life circumstances, the environmental context, the life history of an individual. Mm-hmm. And would not necessarily operate in the same way in every individual.
Now, your research draws on some of the famous Minnesota twin studies data. Well, what can we find from twins when we study them?
Well, twins have been studied a lot, and even today, although the molecular revolution is upon us, even in behavioral genetics, so there are a lot of molecular genetic studies. Even today, if one comes to the conclusion that genetic factor is important in explaining, to some degree, individual differences in behavior, that conclusion is really based on primarily twin adoption and family studies, the types of studies that people have been doing for 40, 50 years. The molecular data just are not replicable enough. There are some genes, like the MAOA that was just alluded to, that do seem, perhaps if replicable, to be important, but they're a very small number at this point. Now, one hopes, of course, that that picture will change over the next 3, 4, 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Matt Ridley, you've in your book you've looked into what animals can teach us.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously, you know, one of the great discoveries of the human genome is that we have a whole lot more in common than we thought, not only with chimpanzees, but also with mice and even with worms and plants and things like that. And one of the things that we've been able to do is do a study on a creature like a fruit fly and then go and see if the same genes are operating in us. And I think one of the fascinating examples of this is the study of learning and memory, where we now know that associative learning, that is, you know, learning to associate one thing with another, is underpinned by a series of 17 genes in the fruit fly called the Krebs genes, each of which have to operate in real time in the brain as you're laying down the gene. These genes are the consequence of behavior, if you like, not the cause of behavior. And when we go and look in mammals, we find exactly the same set of genes doing exactly the same job. Well, exactly is not the right word. They're recognizably similar. We can't obviously do the same experiments on human beings that we can on fruit flies, but to some extent we can on mice, and we can show them doing the same job, which means that a creature that lived 600 million years ago, the common ancestor of us and flies, must have been capable of learning and memory. I think it's rather wonderful that we're able to learn lessons like that at this stage.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's interesting that that perhaps the lesson of the human genome is going to be much more about complexity, ultimately, than it is about reductionism. I think there have been a lot of fears, and certainly social scientists like myself have feared a reductionist bent in the Human Genome Project, but I don't think that's what's coming out of it. This morning at the meeting that we've all been at, the complexity of models and of interactions and of gene-environment interactions that were presented, that seemed to be the lesson of the day, was this sort of interactionism. And I think that when you see 17 genes that affect learning and memory in a fruit fly, or another study from a few months ago about at least that many genes affecting fat metabolism and Drosophila, it makes you more respectful of the complexity that's going to be involved in figuring out anything like a behavior in a human being.
And it also shows that the economy of genes.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to have a one-on-one gene.
Right.
As the Human Genome Project showed us, about only having 30,000 genes instead of about 100,000 we mm-hmm. thought we should be having.
Mm-hmm.
Matt Ridley, does that tell us that we're closer to sharing all these genes with even the fruit flies?
Well, yes. I mean, this 30,000 figure has been much misunderstood, because people say, well, since we've only got a third as many genes as we thought, therefore we must have more nurture and more free will. That's roughly the way some of the newspaper coverage ran, which is a bit odd, because it implies that viruses have the most free will of all, because they have the fewest genes. There's something wrong with the logic there, but you're quite right that the complexity is enormous. You only need 33 genes. Each one coming in a state in one of two states, on or off, and you can give every human being on the planet a unique face, if you like, or something like that. Because you know, 33 to the power of 10 is more than 10 billion possibilities. So with 30,000 genes in combination, sure, we're gonna have enormous possibilities. And it's true that
I've got to break in, Matt.
I'm sorry.
Hang on there. We'll come back. We'll have to take a short break and come back and talk with all of you. So stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. We're talking this hour about genes and human behavior with my guest, Matt Ridley, author of Nature Via Nurture, Genes, Experience, and What Makes Us Human, Pat McGough, past president of the Behavior Genetics Association and professor of psychology at the University of Minnesota. Nancy Press, associate professor in the Department of Public Health and Preventive Medicine at Oregon Health and Science University in Portland. Our number 1-800-989-8255. So is there, I ask this to all of you, is there any conclusions we can make besides the general, hey, you know, it's some nature, hey, it's some nurture? Where have we moved ahead of that? Is there anything we've advanced that argument somehow, some way?
I would say yes, but by small steps, not by large steps. I think that the field has moved beyond the nature versus nurture, or that it's this percentage genes and this percentage environment, to beginning to realize that many times nature and nurture more likely work in concert or synergistically than in opposition. And that's mostly a conceptual advance, but it's an important conceptual advance to get us beyond the wars of 20, 30 years ago.
Is it possible to look at a gene and see it influenced by nature over time, so that something in its instructions changes over time to create some personality difference or something? You understand what I'm driving at? If nurture does have a role, is it a role that is a proactive role in the genome?
Yeah, I mean, if I could come in there,
sure.
There are some very nice examples of genes. They don't get their sequences changed. I mean, that is one thing that's absolutely clear, is that you can't change the code during your lifetime, at least not in a rational way. You can do it accidentally by having mutations, but what you can do is switch the gene on and off. And a lot of these genes are switched on and off by the products of other genes, and the products of those other genes are themselves sometimes at the mercy of the environment. So for example, if you get stressed, if you go through a period of very, very profound stress, you tend to be more likely to catch a cold or a pneumonia or something like that. And the reason for that is because you've actually suppressed your immune system with the stress. Now, the reason you've suppressed your immune system is because cortisol, the hormone produced in response to stress, is actually a transcription factor. That is, it switches on and off genes. And some of the genes it downregulates, it switches off, are actually the ones that that are involved in the immune system. So there's a very nice example of how, you know, something that actually happens outside your body to you in your life, like an unhappy experience, can actually change which genes you have turned on at any one time.
We're seeing a lot of things bad happening from stress. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to Michael in Waterford, Michigan. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Ira.
Hi, go ahead.
I'd like to find out if you or your guests can tell me about, has there been a discovery for a gene for being gay?
Well, you know, that's a really interesting question. There have been there was a fair amount of brouhaha some years ago when Dean Hamer felt that a gene for predisposed for male homosexuality had been found. There hasn't been a lot of strong replication of that work, but I do think that is a very interesting example to think of in terms of why are we looking at this, and how are we thinking about what being a homosexual means. There have been some writers who've talked about the fact that the idea that there is a homosexual as a person, that they're actually homosexual people, is kind of a new idea. Not that there haven't always been people who engaged in homosexual sexual practices, but that looking at a human being as having an identity that was predicated on their sexuality is really something of this century. And that given that, the underpinning of looking for a gene for homosexuality is based on the idea that you think that there are people who are actually homosexuals. Once you start looking for that gene, it kind of, even if you don't find it, it sort of reinforces the idea that this is something immutable. The other interesting thing is that both sides of the political spectrum about homosexuality kind of jumped on the "there's a gene for it" bandwagon. Dr. Hamer himself hoped that if he found a gene that strongly predisposed to being homosexual, it would be a way to say, look, folks, this isn't a choice. This is something biological. There's nothing anyone can do about it. At the same time, people who were very distressed with homosexual behavior said, look, this just proves what we've said all along. This is really an illness. So in a way, I think the pattern is that looking for a gene, whether you find it or not, or whether you find it and then it's not replicated, simply the search for a gene for something has the potential to become a very powerful social fact, which may have lots of consequences.
If I could jump in here.
Go ahead.
So, what we now realize is that even those things like sexual orientation might have some genetic influence upon them, based on twin and adoption studies. We're certain there aren't a single gene for any of these, that there are multiple genes involved and multiple interacting genes, so that we'll never find the gene for sexual orientation or for schizophrenia.
Matt Ridley, any comment?
Yeah, I think one of the most interesting results on homosexuality, which I discuss in my book, is Ray Blanchard's work in Toronto, where he's now got a very strong data set suggesting that some homosexuals, by no means all, but some, are caused by a phenomenon, an early phenomenon in the womb that is not directly genetic, but is nonetheless immutable, or at least semi-irreversible, as it were. And therefore, it's a phenomenon whereby there seems to be an immune reaction between the mother's body and a male fetus in the womb, which builds up over time, so that the more male children she bears, the more likely the latter born ones are to be homosexual. Now that it could be mediated by genes in the fetus and in the mother, so there are probably going to be genes involved. But it is, in the sense that it's an event in the womb. It's a sort of nurture effect, and is likely to lead to just as immutable a result as a direct gene effect would be. So that rather confuses the issue there of irreversible nurture.
So what would you say that actually produces when you say it produces a homosexual? Is that a particular feeling, a particular drive to act in a particular way? Is that drive to act mutable by the environment somebody's in?
Well, it's certainly true that people spend a lot of time in the early 60s trying to so-called cure homosexuality, and some really very cruel experiments were done, and on the whole they proved that a lot of people have very strong drives towards being homosexual. It obviously doesn't express itself in the very first few years of life, but after puberty, most gay people I know feel very strongly that is the way they are. That it's not a condition imposed by society. I think in a way that is rather patronizing to them.
Right, no, but it is not necessarily the way people act. All I'm saying is that there are societies in which, people may not be able to become heterosexuals, but they can always become celibates. I mean, this society creates...
Sure, sure, yeah.
Are there any twin studies about homosexuality?
Sure, there's maybe three or four twin studies, and what they show, not surprisingly, is that monozygotic twins, if one has a homosexual orientation, the other is that has an increased likelihood of also being homosexual, but that's much less the case in dizygotic twins.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to Lisa in Norwell, Mass. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine, how are you? Go ahead, please.
Good. Well, I had to laugh when I heard the subject. I was adopted at 2 months old, and I found my natural family when I was 28. My main concern was just medical history. I had always found the topic of gene and genetics and environment interesting, but I really had no idea until I met my natural family what genetics do mean. It was stunning when I met them.
Can you tell us a little bit about it?
The biggest thing was growing up, and I didn't realize how much until I met them, is that I pretty much felt like an alien in my adoptive family. I wanted to do things that nobody else wanted to. By the age of 10, I had already saved all my pennies and bought my own sewing machine. Come to find out, my mother was a fashion designer.
Huh.
And no one in my adoptive family sewed. Intelligence levels. I have an IQ of 141. Everyone in my natural family is over 130. Personality typing, one of the popular things today is some jobs will personality type. My mother and I are identical. Decorations in the house, the same pets. We both had Siamese cats. I mean, I could go on
and so you're saying a lot of these are behavioral.
Absolutely.
That match.
Absolutely. Every hobby, every interest I had that developed completely of its own accord outside of any interest that my adoptive family had,
were they as astonished? Was your adoptive family as astonished as you are about your natural family, how different you are?
By the time that I found my natural family, my adoptive parents were deceased, so I didn't really have anybody but my husband and my children and the people close to me at that time just could not get over it.
Right.
And everyone said, wow, you hear this argument of environment versus genetics, and, you know, you hear the twin studies, and you go, well, you know, it's probably a 50-50. Well, just from my experience alone, genetics play a much, much larger role. And what we are, what our interests are, how we process information, how we make decisions. I think it's far more genetic.
Let me get a reaction from our guest. Yes.
I'm sorry.
Well, we'll get everybody in. Go ahead.
Okay. Go ahead, Matt.
Okay. Lisa's observation is an interesting one. I've heard it many times. I've been studying a large group of adoptive families in Minnesota, over 300 adoptive families. And one of the things we find, for example, is two adopted siblings growing up in the same home have completely random personalities. They're not similar in any way. At the same time, I don't think we want to say that somehow our genes determine our behavior. I'm thinking of one case of an adopted individual that I know fairly well, who became a very learned individual and expert tennis player. That he certainly acquired from his environment, and in his adopted home, what happened was there were no constraints placed on him. He was allowed to pursue sport even though his adoptive parents weren't athletic themselves. He was allowed to go to the library even though his parents only had one book in the home, the Bible. So, yes, genetics is important, but maybe one of the ways it's important is it might color or influence the choices we make in our life.
I think that's absolutely true. I'm intrigued also to ask whether there were things in which you were more like your adoptive family. I mean, I've heard it say that food preferences are something that we pick up very early from our family environment, but have nothing to do with genetics. Or even sense of humor has been mentioned as something that has very low heritability in that sense.
Let me get an answer from Lisa after I remind everybody that I'm Ira Flatow and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Lisa?
Yes. I feel badly saying this because for any adoptive family, I'm sure it's an uncomfortable thing to hear. But in my situation, anyhow, clearly, the resemblances to my natural family. But keep in mind, I didn't meet until I was 28 years old. I lived with my adopted family from 2 months old. Everything is attributable to my natural family. I really, obviously, there are going to be some behaviors, but it is so much more heavily weighted towards my natural family. It's stunning.
It
was shocking.
What about the food preferences?
Hate mayonnaise and mustard. My mother won't touch them either.
I can't say anything about food preferences.
yeah,
but Lisa might be exceptional in some ways. For example, in the adoptive families we're studying, one area, one domain of psychological functioning that's very important, where we do see similarities among adoptive relatives, is in intellectual achievement, IQ, for example. It's not as great as you would see among biological relatives, but it's definitely there, and it's definitely environmental. There are other areas where you see similarities. Personality does not happen to be one, though.
One hears a lot of these stories, and they're always very powerful. And I can imagine, Lisa, what a powerful experience it was for you. I have to say that one of the ways that it's that it strikes me, though, is that it's when you hear these stories, is that it's almost too much, and what it that there are too many similarities, and what it always most reminds me of is the way people feel when they first fall in love, and it is astonishing to them how they and their this person that they've fallen in love with are so alike and think so much the same way, and you know, had the same favorite movie that they saw in a movie theater that seemed really similar, and on and on. And then over time, when you actually live with that person, you can't believe how many ways you're not the same. So I guess I feel like there may be some selection going on in that situation, but I'm sure it's a really powerful experience when it's happening.
The experience was extremely powerful and overwhelming, but keep in mind, you're going back almost 15 years now.
Mm-hmm.
So I've had quite an amount of time to have that love phase, that rush pass by, and my mother lives 5 minutes down the street. So mm-hmm. we have now had 15 years together quite closely. So I think I might be beyond that phase, and actually, a lot of it didn't even start to hit me for probably about 5 years.
Okay, Lisa, this is quite interesting, and we want to thank you for calling. And good luck to you.
Thank you.
Take care. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. I imagine you're tempted to say this is so astounding. It's almost like I heard you saying, Nancy, that it's almost like being romanticized in her own mind.
Well, it's just hard for me to figure out what the mechanism is to have a gene for selecting a Siamese cat as a pet. You know, it's not this woman at all, but and I can imagine that growing up in a family that being adopted by a family that you're very different from can be painful. But lots of stories about twins separated at birth who find that they both drive blue Chevys, and you know, I would just wonder what year they bought cars and what city they were living in and how many blue Chevys there were that were around. It's hard for me to give a lot of credence to a genetic explanation, but Matt,
I think coincidences play a role. But take the Siamese cat.
Mm-hmm.
There certainly is no gene, or even multiple genes for having a Siamese cat. But having a cat probably relates to personality characteristics like being caring and nurturant, and those we know are heritable characteristics. So
mm-hmm.
it's not completely out of the question.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to have to take a short break and come back and talk lots more about this. This fascinating. We'll have to say goodbye to Matt Ridley. Thank you for joining us. I know you've got to go.
Thank you very much for having me.
Matt Ridley's new book is Nature via Nurture, Genes, Experience, and What Makes Us Human. We'll be back with our other two guests, Matt McGew and Nancy Press. To stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A brief program note: to join Neil Conan on Talk of the Nation in this hour on Monday for discussion on how to try Iraq's war criminals. We're talking this hour about genes and behavior with my guest, Matt McGew, past president of the Behavior Genetics Association and professor of psychology, University of Minnesota, Nancy Press, associate professor in the Department of Public Health and Preventive Medicine at the Oregon Health and Science University. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Matt, Nancy, where does research go from here? Are there questions you can answer by doing more research, and what would those be? What would you like to know? I always give the blank check question to my guests. If you had all the money in the world, what would you do? What kind of research would you do?
Well, I think they're actually the research that's being done now, that's being funded, is exactly the type of research we need to do. And that is, at this point, we really need to the twin and adoption studies do suggest there are these genetic factors for behavior. We need to find what those are. And those involve large-scale studies of families, of SIB pairs, of individuals from throughout the world. So that's where I'd place my money. Now, in saying that, I think it's important to recognize that if you look at most psychological characteristics, whether or not you're extroverted or introverted, how well you do in school, what your occupational interests turn out to be. Most of those, we really don't know the origins or the determinants of those. We don't understand the environment very well. And the hope is that if genes and environment do act in concert, if we can really nail down the genetic side of the equation, like the MAO study you were talking about earlier, we'll begin to get a better understanding of how the environment works as well.
Nancy Press?
Well, let's see. I think I would have a research, a three-prong research program. The first is I would like Matt to tell me if there is a gene for newspaper headline writers and see what we can do about that. because I think that that a lot of mischief is created by the genes for kind of language, which is not what I hear from my careful scientific colleagues, but does wind up in the press a lot. I did a Google search the other day for just on the phrase genes for, and in 6/100ths of a second, I got 770 references, a lot of which were for behavioral traits. And in most cases, when you read the story, the gap between what the headline said had been found and what had actually been found was very great. And I think that that, you know, that that shapes public perception. The other thing is, I really would like to, as I was saying, I think before, rather than just thinking about genes versus environment or genes together with environment, I would like to always be thinking about the phenotype, how we are defining the thing that we're looking for a gene or an environmental influence on. And I think that there has been not nearly enough work that has been sensitive to looking at things cross-culturally. Schizophrenia is a situation in which the phenotype, as I said it before, is quite well defined, and it's known that the rates of schizophrenia are quite similar cross-culturally. That to me lends a robustness to the idea that there is something very deeply biological, genetic about schizophrenia. But there are, I think that there's a lot of playing fast and loose with terms like novelty seeking and risk taking, set points for happiness, even alcoholism, where it would be very interesting to make sure that you had something that was cross-culturally valid before you started looking for a gene for it.
How do these stories get started? You know, today we found a gene, let's say, for alcoholism. We found a gene for this. We found a gene, you know, for spousal abuse, things like that. How do these things get started?
Well, you know, one story that's building now, and maybe I'm sure Matt knows more about it than I do, but it was one of the things that I came across in this Google search, seemed to have started with some very solid research by Neil Risch, a tremendously respected biologist, who has been working on a specific gene which is very involved in the ability to perceive bitterness as a taste. And the way that got transmuted in the press, it started to, I found stories about the connection of this finding and smoking addiction, healthy diet, therefore, you know, finding this gene might then lead to longevity and better health practices. And as far as I know, and I hope Matt will correct me, all that Neil Risch was really talking about was the ability to perceive a flavor.
Yeah, I confess I'm not familiar with the work. I apologize. But I think what happens is that the scientific reports necessarily get simplified when they're reported in the media. Unfortunately, in that simplification, in that translation, what's lost is the notion that genes act, when we're talking about behavior, they act at best probabilistically, not deterministically. They convey risk, maybe for alcoholism or schizophrenia, but they don't really determine whether or not you're schizophrenic. It depends on the environment you grow up in.
Then how do you actually determine a gene is responsible for any behavior?
Well, again, at this point, the number of actual genes, if you get away from mental retardation, which there are quite a few genes that have been determined, mostly that are related to some neurological damage. But if you get away from mental retardation and you look at complex behavioral characteristics, the number of actual genes known to in some way influence behavior is very small at this point. I don't think behavior is altogether different from other complex phenotypes in that regard, though. Most of the major genetic discoveries up to this point of genes are due to Mendelian disorders, single gene disorders like Huntington's disease and cystic fibrosis. Trying to unravel the genetics of complex disorders or phenotypes like diabetes or schizophrenia or bipolar disorder or depression is just much, much more difficult. And the progress is slow in all those cases. And I don't think behavior is altogether different.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Hugh in Milwaukee. Hi, Hugh.
Hi. I'm sorry you couldn't get somebody who, like Professor Michael Levin, who could give a very different point of view from Nancy on this kind of thing. Often behaviors and genetics, how do we go about thinking of the, they are linked? For example, American Indians were often denied alcohol, the sale of alcohol to American Indians, because it was felt that somehow it affected them in a different way, perhaps genetically, whatever. I'm sure the laws have changed over the years. But there was an assumption made that alcohol and the American Indian were not always a good combination. The Irish tend to be higher among alcoholics, too, if I'm not mistaken. Is there a genetic reason for that? We don't know. But because of certain behaviors, we might at least suspect that there might be something. Why is it one group tends to dominate as sprinters and in athletics? Why is it the IQ test that Nancy so... she talks about 100 years ago the IQ test began, and yes, there were mistakes at the beginning of any science. But she and Stephen Jay Gould, who always wrote about what IQs were doing 100 years ago, they never went beyond that. Why does the left try to discredit the IQ and Burt's fine record? Why does the left want to defund the twin?
Who's the left?
The left wing, the ideology of today. This is the one that says you can't have group differences. Men and women are essentially the same. They think the same. Women are just as good as math and all this nonsense. This is the left-wing ideology that says there cannot be genetic differences, and this distorts science. It's not social science they're talking about. It's social unscience. It's social anti-science for the last 50 years.
Any comment, Matt?
Wow, that's hard to... where to begin? I think actually... Hugh, I think people are looking at genetic strategies in different groups. I think primarily with disorders like diabetes that do vary, and maybe even in alcoholism, that do vary in risk across ethnic groups. And I don't think people would necessarily rule out, for example, in diabetes, that there might be genetic factors that express itself different in different groups. At this point, though, it's pure speculation. I think the reason, quite honestly, that people shy away from it is that the types of issues you bring up, let's say the IQ issue and group differences in IQ, is that there's no way to resolve the issue. It's just pure speculation. At this point, there's no scientific evidence that can be brought to bear on it.
I do have a very extremely non-argumentative response, I hope, about alcoholism, which again has to do with the term. I don't doubt that there are differences in alcohol metabolism that may be group-specific. I think when you get to a situation like the American Indians, though, there are just a lot of intervening factors, and one of those factors probably is a way of metabolizing alcohol, but I think one then has to look at an entire social situation that made alcoholism problematic, that also probably made lots of other kinds of social dysfunction and depression problematic, and had a lot to do with the circumstances in which Native Americans have been living. So I think what's dangerous is the leap from some sort of metabolizing of alcohol, which may make a group of people more prone to direct the, you know, misery and social problems in that particular direction. To go from the metabolism to the social behavior, you see, you have to realize there are a lot of things that intervene there.
Mm. Nancy bringing up alcohol metabolism actually reminds me of an important example, in that there is a gene that does vary by ethnicity. A gene involved in the metabolism of alcohol. A variant of the gene is actually, for the most part, only carried by East Asian, and about 50% of East Asians carry this variant of this enzyme. Having the variant makes you sick when you drink. Therefore, it's highly protective against the development of alcoholism, but only in East Asians.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the interesting things that we've seen with the carriers of this gene is that as time has gone on, the protective effect of the gene is diminishing. It's still protective, but it's nowhere near as protective today as it was 25 years ago. And the explanation for that is that our environment has changed. We've become much more accepting, or at least East Asian cultures have become more accepting of alcohol. consumption, and as they have, the importance of the gene in protecting against alcoholism in that group has diminished over time.
Talking about Nature Nurture this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I guess, you know, this is politically charged issues. Correct? I mean, the accusation by it was Matt, that this is left-wing versus right-wing sort of stuff makes it politically charged. Let's go to the phones and get another call from Dave in Portland, Oregon. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'll make this brief. Steven Pinker has written a book in which he has argued that although the nature versus nurture debate is largely over within the scientific community, it's very much alive in the larger culture, and that indeed many of our cultural, our political, our moral beliefs are based on inappropriate assumptions about the primacy of nurture. And I wondered if your folks could comment. I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Okay. Nancy?
Well, I do think that it's certainly true that this is just a topic that is very very close to people, and I think one of the challenges for scientists and science writers is to be able to get people to listen to a more nuanced message, which doesn't satisfy, I think, the desire for certainty that a lot of people have. And I think that genetic explanations are very powerful for a lot of reasons. I have a colleague who's a geneticist who said that it has never been difficult for her to convince somebody that that a disease that appears in more than one person in the family is a genetic disease, but it's very difficult for her to convince somebody that a disease that appears in two members of the family happened that way coincidentally.
Dr. Press, I've got to wrap it up. I want to thank you very much for joining us. Nancy Press, Associate Professor in the Department of Public Health and Preventive Medicine, Oregon Health and Science University in Portland. Matt McGew is a past president of the Behavioral Genetics Association and Professor of Psychology, University of Minnesota in the Twin Cities. Thank you both for joining me this hour.
Thank you.
We've run out of time. Our program is produced by Annette Heiss, Charles Berquist, Adrian McDonald, and Senior Producer Karen Vergoth. Charles Berquist, also our director. If you'd like to write us, please send your letters to Talk of the Nation Science Friday, 1221 6th Avenue, 36th floor, New York, New York, 10020. Or you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where we'll have Science Friday's Kids Connection, where we make learning materials, curricula for students and teachers, free for your taking from the website. Also, you can hear the program archives Science Friday in real audio or download them on your Audible player. And also check for transcripts if you'd like to order those. I'm Ira Flato in New York.